This is an ABC podcast.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Oh, the nights are long and I'm so tired of waking up tired.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is where the conversation begins.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria. This is the Conversation Hour.
And I'm so tired of waking up tired.
So we can all have a bad night's sleep. But what if that goes on for months, years, even decades? Do you live with insomnia? And what classifies insomnia? What causes it? Is there a cure? And how does it impact your life and your mental health? Good morning. I'm Rochelle Hunt, your co-host this morning. Nick Healy joining you from ABC Shepparton. Nick, the term insomnia, right, we throw it around fairly loosely. That idea of when you wake up in the middle of the night and you can't get back to sleep. Is that insomnia?
Look, 30 years ago when I was doing my psychology degree, we used to define it as if you had 3 nights in a week of poor sleep, either waking up early or difficulty going to sleep, difficulty staying asleep. I assume it's changed a lot from then, but we used to talk about acute insomnia where you just have a little period of it. It was awful. You felt bad. And the people who got the chronic insomnia, the ones that you were mentioning before, people who honestly had not been able to sleep for decades. Now, I am obsessed with sleep. I don't sleep well at the best of times. I track it every single night. I could tell you to the minute the average amount of sleep I've get. I've played around. I've experimented with what they call polyphasic sleeping, where I've actually split my sleep into two different blocks and gone to the gym at 3 a.m. to have a little break in between them.
I've always wondered who those people were.
I've tried to hack my sleep to try and get more sleep. This topic I find so fascinating, and I just know we're going to hear from a lot of people who have trouble sleeping. It feels like a very now curse.
And there, I could imagine, and we'll learn this today, that there would be periods of your life where you will experience insomnia. I experienced it for years. My daughter, when she was first born, even now she's not a great sleeper, but she was a chronic, awful sleeper, would wake around the clock. I tried everything. I had sleep experts come to the house, you name it. I was at my wit's end. You know, I was literally crying in my hallway with this sleep expert saying, I haven't slept in a year. Like, I get 2-3 hours consecutive and that's it. And I felt like I was going insane. And ever since then, I've never been a good sleeper. So I wonder if there are key moments in your life where something happens. Maybe you change your work. Maybe there's stresses. I don't know. Maybe as we age. But I wonder if your sleep ever goes back to, inverted commas, normal again.
Look, as someone who keeps weird hours courtesy of breakfast radio, I'm very interested to know if I ever stopped doing the hours I've got, would I go back to just having 8 hours sleep or not? The question, can you catch insomnia, is fascinating to me. Is it something that you don't just develop because of, you know, where you sit and maybe a physical condition or a mental condition? Mm-hmm. Is it something that environmentally we can find ourselves having insomnia? But what you were highlighting was how important this is. This isn't just about feeling a bit groggy and a bit tired. The health detriments can be enormous physically and mentally.
Absolutely. And it's not just children, strangely. And this may sound a little bit ludicrous, but I'm going there, and I think you're going to go there with me, Nick. Pets can have a big impact on our sleep. Now, look, I roll my eyeballs at that. But actually, part of the reason why I've said no to pets in our household is because I'm only just starting to sleep again. Don't give me a puppy, for God's sake.
Look, I am a well-acknowledged crazy cat gentleman. I'd have a house full of cats if I was allowed to. I've got two. I'm very much pets belong in the bed. They should spend all their time with you. I have a 17-year-old cat called Lola who's experiencing dementia at the moment, and I love her to pieces, but she keeps getting lost in the house and screaming, and she does that most of the night. So she's having a huge impact on my sleep at the moment, the poor little lady.
Oh, so maybe you live with insomnia. Maybe you've had periods of it. Maybe you have a cat like Lola and it's helping ensure that you don't get a good night's sleep. Or maybe there is someone in your house who lives with insomnia. And how does that impact you?
This is where the conversation begins.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour.
And I'm so tired of waking up tired.
And in a couple of days, it will be World Sleep Day. So you're probably going to hear a lot about sleep, whether it be a period of your life or any texts coming in that simply just say menopause, full stop. Mm. So that will be a part of today. Another Nick that says, great topic. I'm wondering whether the role of alcohol, maybe a glass of wine with dinner, affects our hormones related to sleep in those early hours of the morning, the old 2 to 4 a.m. Don't you love the 2 to 4 a.m. wake up and you start to go over and over something that happened in about 1986 and you stew over it and you try and figure out why you said something or did something that has no significance to your life whatsoever.
Well, you know what's interesting when you say that is, as someone who gets up at about a quarter past four to be in work for my 5:30 start, I now have that similar experience, but it's more likely to be 11 where I've been asleep for a couple of hours. So, like, yeah. I'm still getting that kind of 2 to 4. It's just time shifted.
Leon Lack is an emeritus professor of academic status. He's from the College of Education, Psychology and Social Work at Flinders University. Leon, a warm welcome to the Conversation Hour. What defines insomnia?
Oh, thanks, Rochelle. Look, you and Nick made a wonderful introduction and opened up the question to lots of questions. And Nick, you're pretty much spot on. But, you know, these days now, the definition of insomnia not only requires that people have difficulty either getting off to sleep or waking up a lot during the night for long periods of time, but it needs to have some daytime consequence of it as well. So, and I do encounter quite a few people in the older age group who come in and are worried about their sleep because they wake up once or twice across the night. And they say, you know, this shouldn't be happening. It never happened when I was young. And now they're starting to experience awakenings across the night, and they consider that poor sleep. In fact, our culture considered poor sleep. For the last couple hundred years after industrialization, we've collapsed our sleep period into one monophasic sleep period. And that has become the norm, and therefore it has become defined as normal and healthy. But in fact, most of the world's population still has a siesta during the day and a shorter sleep at nighttime than we do. And polyphasic sleep, you mentioned that. And different species have polyphasic sleep too and seem to get along quite all right on that. one of the problems that I face a lot of the time with my clients is that they are worried about these awakenings and they consider them to be abnormal. And we even have a language and terms to call it a broken sleep, disturbed sleep, if we have an awakening at night. And that's unfortunate because awakenings at night are actually part of the normal sleep pattern.
Are
and people
really?
Don't appreciate that. Yes, we go through what are called sleep cycles. Go down into deep sleep over a period of an hour or so, hour and a half, and then we come into lighter sleep spontaneously. And in that lighter sleep, we might go into what's called rapid eye movement sleep, dreaming sleep. But that's a light sleep phase that occurs about every 90 minutes across the whole sleep period.
But the difference would be in that light period if you wake up and then you're awake for a long period of time before you fall back into that next rhythm.
Yes, that's right. If you fall back to sleep within 5 or 10 minutes, there's no problem. But the problem is that people waking up at that time consider that to be pathological. They start getting worried about it, and then that worry extends their wake time, and that can slowly develop into chronic insomnia. And so one of the first things I have to do is to educate the public, really, to say that awakenings across the night are not abnormal. They're actually programmed into us. You should accept them as being part of the normal sleep pattern. If you get back to sleep within 5 or 10 minutes, like a lot of people get up and go to the toilet maybe once or twice across the night, and they get worried about that. Well, the worry itself is unfortunate. That'll be the thing that may result in the development of chronic insomnia, because worry associated with being awake at night then becomes a trigger for maintaining wakefulness. So the old, Pavlovian conditioning.
Yeah, you know, the stress of going to bed, going, will it happen again? Will it happen again? What will happen tonight?
And that can affect how long it takes you to get to sleep then. So the development of chronic insomnia is a learned habit pattern that starts developing through the association of being anxious or worried in bed when you're trying to sleep. And so putting yourself into that circumstance in bed, trying to sleep, automatically triggers off that worry response, and that delays getting back to sleep.
Leon, is it only worry and anxiety? Are there actually some physical medical conditions that can create insomnia?
Oh, sure. Probably the biggest is pain. So if a person's in pain, that is an automatic arousing mechanism. And that's adaptive. You know, if you're in pain, something's attacking your body. And so you need to deal with it. So it's an alerting mechanism. So, yes, different medical conditions, different drugs, stimulants, too much coffee during the day can make it difficult to get to sleep. When I mean too much, I mean more than, say, 2 or 3 cups of strong coffee, particularly towards bedtime.
That idea of having insomnia for a certain period, Leon, there's another text here that says, I developed insomnia when I was breastfeeding my baby girl, who I also needed to pump for. This technique from perinatal psychologists helped me overcome my fear of sleep and insomnia. I'm now breastfeeding a 7-week-year-old with no issues so far on my own sleep hygiene. If you go for certain periods of time, whether it be a cat with dementia or breastfeeding or a period of shift work, whatever it may be, do you revert back to how you used to sleep?
Most people will. And so parents that are responsible for waking up at nighttime to an infant because they need to be fed across the night and changed will go through a period of disturbed sleep then. And that may carry on for a period of time afterwards. And even when the infant or toddler is sleeping through the whole night, the person that was responsible for getting up during the night and attentive to things that happen in the night may still have a lingering sensitivity to anything that happens the night. My own personal story is similar to that. My partner had no problems with our child because I was the one responsible for getting up to her when she cried at nighttime, and I would bring her in.
10 points for that, by the way.
To be breastfed. My partner hardly woke up at all, did the breastfeeding. I took the baby back to the cot to try to get it back to sleep again. So I became the one that was super sensitive to the little crying baby at nighttime. And I was left for a period of time after our child was sleeping through the night, left with a period of lighter sleep and more attentive to things that happened in the nighttime, and my partner wasn't.
Huh.
So that experience lingered with me for a while and eventually faded out when I had no further responsibilities over a period of time.
Leon, looking at chronic insomnia, anecdotally, it feels like it's on the rise. I feel like more and more people have been talking about it in the last decade and a half. Is that reflected in the study?
It's very difficult to try to assess changes in something like this over time because it really depends on the definition of insomnia. In other words, how much difficulty people are having getting to sleep and getting back to sleep and how impaired they feel during the day. Getting back to that original definition, if people are experiencing awakenings across the night, for example, or, problems getting off to sleep, but they don't experience any daytime fatigue or distress, they're getting on with their lives quite all right, then they probably are meeting their sleep need. So the old definition of insomnia with disrupted sleep is no longer sort of appropriate. It really needs to be paired up with daytime impairments, which in the chronic insomnia is present.
Leon Lack is with you, Emeritus Professor of Academic Status with the College of Education, Psychology and Social Work at Flinders University. He's been teaching and conducting research in the area of sleep and circadian rhythms and insomnia since 1972. This text here, it says, Rish and guests, I've had a bad sleep on account of my partner snoring. I get up early and go to bed early, hoping to have 6 hours of even broken sleep. That's from Rhonda. And again, anecdotally, lots of people are talking about now choosing to have separate bedrooms from their partners so that each other gets a really good night's sleep. Let's have a chat to Lynn, who's in Yakandanda. Morning, Lynn.
Oh, hi. Good morning, everyone. Look, this is fabulous. This works with my granddaughter when she sleeps over and she can't go to sleep. We play a game called What's Inside Your Head? And one person chooses something, say an apple, and the other person has to keep asking questions till they get it right.
Mm.
And we go backwards and forwards maybe 3 or 4 times and then we fall asleep.
So you've got your little techniques. That's it. I have a little game with my daughter. I'll draw a picture on her back and she has to guess what the picture is and then she eventually just kind of falls asleep. Do those little techniques work, do you think, Leon?
Well, I think they distract the person who's trying to sleep from the attempt to fall asleep. And that distraction certainly may help, because one of the triggers for becoming anxious about your sleep and therefore having difficulty getting to sleep is the desire to get to sleep and the realization that it's not happening. So the frustration of trying to fall asleep. When people try hard to fall asleep, and many other clients will say, "But I try hard to fall asleep," you know, as if that was a good thing. But I try to reassure them that no. Look, the best thing to do is not to try at all, and be distracted by something else.
I thought this was just me, but Susan in Launching Place says, I get these songs that go on and on in my head when I hit the pillow. Oh, my God, this is me. I turn the light back on and then I need to do something to distract myself, like reading. As soon as I try to sleep again, the song starts again. This has been happening for years. I find myself feeling quite anxious before I sleep because I need to sleep and I can't. I once heard, I don't know if this is true or not, and Leon, you might be able to help me with this, but the idea that you get a song stuck in your head is your brain trying to give you something to focus on to help deal with whatever anxiety you're going through at the time. It's giving you something else to focus on. But I'm like Susan at Launching Place. I get a song on loop in my head and it takes a lot to get that thing out.
Mm. In the business, we call that an earworm. And I do some singing in my spare time, and I get those a lot of the time. If you've been practicing a certain song quite a bit, I end up with that going through my head for a long time afterwards. But, you know, instead of trying to get rid of it, I mean, unless it's a song that you hate, you know, go with
then
it, perhaps.
Generally not,
you know?
Great songs. And,
that's a pity.
But it is difficult to break that thought cycle, you know, for many people, a lot of people texting in, myself too. Sometimes the anxiety of not being able to sleep is what continues. You start thinking about everything you're going to have to do tomorrow on too little sleep, and it adds into that concern. It becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy almost.
Yes, absolutely. And that's why sometimes for those situations that some sort of relaxation technique or meditation or distraction can be useful. So in other words, focusing attention upon some non-provocative idea or image or sound, and even this earworm, that could work.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Rochelle Hunt and Nick Healy with you as we talk about insomnia, what defines it and are there ways of dealing with it. With you from our South Australia studios, Leon Lack, Emeritus Professor from the College of Education, Psychology and Social Work at Flinders University.
Now, I just wanted to quickly say to Adriana, as someone who gets up at 4:30, I have a silent alarm that I use. It's a little device that sits on my wrist, so at no point does any noise go off. And I've also got a smart lamp that slowly brightens up in the room, and that's how I do it without waking up a partner. Don't know if that can help, but
I've heard of ones that sort of slowly bring up music, as opposed to the alarm that I have from about 1985.
Just blasts. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No. Get rid of all of that. I haven't had a physical alarm go off in about 6 years now. I just do it with either a vibration or a light. Now, Robert Adams is Professor of Respiratory and Sleep Medicine at Flinders University. Robert, many, many people coming in saying that when they've got partners who snore too much, they have an impacted sleep as well. And it's kind of linking, I guess, apnea and insomnia quite closely.
It is indeed. Sleep apnea and insomnia, surprisingly, perhaps, occur quite commonly together.
What's the difference?
What's the difference? Insomnia is where you really can't get to sleep, or you wake up easily, or your sleep is disturbed, and then you feel lousy during the day because your sleep has been disrupted. Sleep apnea is a condition where your upper airway repetitively blocks off throughout the night while you're sleeping, and that disrupts your breathing, and there's sort of major effects on the rest of your body in terms of your heart, your lungs, and your brain.
What actually causes sleep apnea? Is it something that you, I mean, how do you get it? I'm presuming you're not born with it, or maybe you are.
Few people are born with it. It does happen in childhood, and that's usually because children can sometimes have big adenoids and tonsils, and that blocks their upper airways off. And I'm sure many of you and your listeners have you know, heard children struggling to breathe through their nose. In adults, it tends to be a different problem. One of the main issues is a small upper airway, and that often comes when we put on weight as we get older. And just restricts the amount of space you've got there. But there's a few other things as well that contribute to it, as well as how strong our muscles are in the upper airway. Mm. And the tendency we have to wake up more easily is what we call the arousal threshold, and how well we control our breathing through our brain.
Robert, anecdotally, I hear from people saying that they know their partner's got apnea, and that's how people find out about it. Someone saying, "Do you realise how much you stop breathing during your sleep?" Is it something that you will know that you have? Is it possible to be living with it if you're by yourself and just not realise why you're so tired all the time?
Yeah, I mean, sure. The commonest reason is probably the elbow sign, where someone gets poked in the ribs because they're snoring.
Or bangs on the bed.
Or bangs on the bed. Or more generously, people point out to them that they're stopping breathing, and that could be a problem. Many people with sleep apnea don't know they've got it themselves. They go to sleep and wake up in the morning, or think they wake up in the morning and haven't had a problem. And they often find they sleep well because they're often sleepy because the quality of their sleep is poor. Sometimes, though, some people wake up feeling like they're choking. And that's because they are.
Oh, gosh. How do you treat it? I mean, I know my mother-in-law wears the mask and tries to find different ways to deal with her sleep apnea. Are there different ways of being able to treat it?
There are. I mean, the commonest treatment is the mask, which is a positive airways pressure machine, which blows air from the device at positive pressure to the atmosphere, and it just splints your airway open. And for people who can tolerate it, it's a great treatment because it works. It works extremely well, and it fixes the problem. Not everyone can tolerate that, and it's not for everybody. Some of the other ways we manage it is with what we call an oral therapy device or a mandibular splint. And it's kind of a mouth guard, top and bottom on your teeth, and it pulls your lower jaw forward on your top jaw and just creates a bit more space at the back of your throat. And that can be quite effective for quite a number of people. One of the other things that sometimes gets done is just getting people off their back. So what we call a posture control device, because your sleep apnea tends to be worse if you're on your back because gravity pushes everything and closes off your airway. Mm. And so getting people off their back can work. There are surgical techniques for some people. It doesn't work for everybody, but for the people, again, the surgery these days is much better than it was maybe 15, 20 years ago because the techniques have been refined. And surgery can be quite effective for a select group of people.
So it seems like there's quite a few solutions if people, go and they speak to their doctor, if their partner has raised concerns or if they've got concerns themselves that maybe they're not sleeping well and are stopping breathing, because it can sometimes be, hundreds of times a night, Robert, we know, and this is something that affects people's sleep a lot. We know you have another commitment, so thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Not a problem. Thanks very much.
Robert Adams there, a professor of respiratory and sleep medicine at Flinders University. I loved that he said there that getting people off their back, which I feel like, Leon, it has justified me saying to my husband, roll over, right? Because it's something and a technique that works. We might take some calls now, Leon, if that's all right. Let's go to Brian, who's in Blackburn. Morning, Brian.
Oh, good morning. I've got this issue with sleep, but I've overcome it with a thing called white noise. Mm-hmm. Now, I select a channel on the radio and I put it off the channel and it just...
Yeah, white noise is a ripper, and it was something that I was told. I used to stand in front of, I used to put the dryer on in the house with nothing in it and then try and rock my daughter to sleep because the noise of the dryer would help her sleep. And you can get apps, can't you, Leon? White noise apps.
Yes, I believe you can. I'm not a big app person, but you can get white noise and you can get pink noise and brown noise, and they tend to just vary the high frequencies a little bit. White noise can be a little bit harsh, sounding a bit like shh, like that. Brown noise is more like shh, and it cuts out some of those high frequencies, so it's a little bit gentler. You can also get lots of apps with natural noises, small waves crashing on the beach, birds singing, and so forth. And so if you find something that you really like to listen to, that can become a good distraction then, just like the meditative techniques that I was mentioning earlier.
So, Leon, my sense is that, yes, that may work for some people, but it's not going to be everyone's, you know, cup of tea listening to a hiss to letting them get to sleep. There's nothing that it's actually necessarily doing to your neurochemistry that's going to make you sleep.
No, that's right. And often those white and brown noises are used if there's a lot of background noise that's more disturbing to you, like planes flying overhead or a lot of traffic outside. Then having some device that brings on this noise, constant noise, is something that you can habituate to or get used to very easily and tends to mask the other less predictable noises, which are more likely to disrupt your sleep.
We've got Anthony on the line from Kensington.
Oh, hi. I've been having a problem for a while now. So I seem to wake up early and I'd worry about getting back to sleep again. And that happens every day, and it's really crippling for the rest of the day. Yeah.
Absolutely, Anthony. I mean, and that's the thing, Leon, when you're not getting enough sleep and when you're stressing about it, are we doing more work and research now into how it affects our waking life, how it affects our ability to function and our mental health?
Yes, and you know, you had an earlier question about do I think that the prevalence of the chronic insomnia is increasing over the last couple of decades? I would really like to know that because I reckon that one of the contributors to it is all the information that we are now putting out to the public through the media about the dangerous effects of not getting adequate sleep. So that's something that people with chronic insomnia are very likely to dwell on and increase their anxiety when they feel like they're not getting enough sleep. The fact is that a lot of these studies are large survey studies that find a small effect that we can't explain how that effect arises, but it's implied that it comes from too little sleep. And these surveys have been pretty consistent, but the effects are not very large, and we don't know where the effects are coming from. It may be that only a small percentage of the population are voluntarily reducing the amount of sleep they get, might be staying up later than they need to, eating junk food. And so we find that there's a slight increase in cardiovascular disease and diabetes and obesity. My typical chronic insomniacs that I see are usually not obese at all. Tend to be on the thinner side, if anything. So they're the ones that tend to get worried about the not getting adequate sleep. And that worry has been, I think, amplified over the last couple of decades with these survey studies that the media love to get onto because they're dramatic. Whereas the real risk is much less than that, and it's overblown.
There's plenty of texts coming in on perimenopause and menopause. We'll get to that in just a moment. And also plenty of texts with you, Nick, saying, yes, my cat wakes me up at 5 a.m. every day. Plus having teenagers and young adults who are awake late, I got more sleep when I had newborns.
on the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt and Nick Healy with you as we look at insomnia this morning. What causes it? What defines insomnia? And lots of texts, Nick, coming through talking about young children and having young children. But it's not just young children maybe coming into your bed in the middle of the night or the debate around co-sleeping. It's also the pets. It's the dogs that want to sleep on your legs. It's the cats who... Am I right in thinking that you tuck your cat into bed of an evening?
Look, Lola's never been an under-the-covers cat, but my other cat, Salem, yes, he likes to spoon, especially in winter, so he needs to be tucked under the
doona. Does he have a pillow?
He uses my arm.
Aww.
So I sleep on my side, so I put my hand under my head, and then he puts his head on my bicep, and we doze off.
So, I don't know.
You're looking at me in horror, but I find it very adorable.
It's adorable, but then there's the issue of cat hair in the bed. That's a whole other conversation, really, isn't it? Kate Mormont is a pet behaviourist. Kate, there are so many texts of people talking about either their pets or possums, waking them up overnight. If you've got a cat that has dementia, like Nick, that maybe just screams most of the night. If you've got a dog that needs toilet training, pets quite seriously can keep us awake.
Yes, they absolutely can. And it can be for different reasons and pets in different stages of their lives. But, yeah, at times throughout their life, they can definitely impact our sleep.
In your work, Kate, do you see a lot of people coming to you and saying, I can't sleep, this animal's driving me up the wall?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, quite a few. So from my experience, some of the more common reasons why are separation anxiety. So when they get a new puppy, that can be an issue, as well as needing to toilet that puppy. But I have also seen it when people move in together, and previously they may have had a nice big bed to themselves with their pets, but then having to share together, that can cause an issue just because there's not enough room and people's sleep is being disturbed.
I know for some people, especially getting young animals or getting a puppy or a kitten, it can be quite a shock if you're not used to it. How much work goes into making sure that they know when it's bedtime, they know where they're supposed to sleep, and they get that sort of, I don't know, for want of a better term, pet sleep hygiene drilled into them?
It's such a good point. So really the most important thing is to decide before you even bring a pet into your home where they're going to sleep, and be consistent in teaching the pet where their bed is and where they sleep, and not allowing them in the bed, because once the pet realises they can sleep in the bed, they tend to want to do that all the time.
See, that you could substitute a small child there, right? And that is easier said than done, because in the middle of the night, when you just want to get some sleep, you're like, get in the bed, you know, and all of your hard work that you've been doing with sleep training for the week before becomes undone. Do you find that this is lifelong? And I guess the similarities between children and pets can be a bit gross, I guess, but there are similarities here.
Yes, there are. There are absolutely similarities. But I think it just comes back to, if you do take some steps back, whether it's with a child or a pet with their sleep training, get back on track as soon as possible and just be consistent. Because if you're inconsistent, your pets, just like with kids, you know, once they know there's a chance that they might be able to stay in the bed, they tend to keep trying. So that's where being really consistent and not allowing them in the bed if you don't want them to sleep there is really important.
So, Kate, just so I can be very clear here and maybe lord it over Rochelle a little bit, you're not saying that pets can't be in the bed. You're just saying they have to be consistent.
Yes, absolutely. So pets can be in the bed.
With the pillow and tucked in.
Because pets can provide a lot of comfort for people. Yeah. So some people, research has shown they actually sleep better if their pet is in bed with them. But it's more about deciding what you want the rules to be and just trying to be consistent with that.
Now, Kate, just in one of my situations, I mentioned earlier I've got an older cat. She's 17 turning 18. She is having some cognitive decline. She's got a small amount of dementia at the moment. She gets a bit lost at night, essentially, and will start screaming when she really doesn't know where she is. It's really quite heartbreaking. Also, incredibly terrifying to hear when you're waking up to it. It's awful. One of the suggestions I've had is to keep her locked in a room with a light on so that she can't sort of wander too far, can see around a little bit. But that's a change in behaviour for her. I mean, would there be a benefit to doing that?
So, yeah, I suppose there'd be a benefit in terms of your sleep quality and perhaps discussing with the vet whether there are any medications that can help with her cognitive decline. Yeah, but you could absolutely set her up in another room where she's got a comfy bed, all the nice things that she likes having around, toys and whatever else, and just make that her new routine. It's probably not going to impact her that much if she's got cognitive decline, but if you make it a really nice space for her, you might find that she transitions quite well.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. It's been really good to speak with you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Kate Mortimer, who's a pet behaviourist. Leon Lack is with you and is taking your calls, Emeritus Professor of Academic Status from the College of Education, Psychology and Social Work at Flinders University. Jennifer's been waiting patiently, who's in Hepburn. Good morning, Jennifer.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call, guys. I'm 55 and I live in Wheatsheaf. And I've always been a shocking sleeper, but since about 2020-21, we have 24 hours a day a low frequency sound in our area. So I'm waking up between 3:30 and 4 every morning with, it feels like a vibrational palpitation in my chest. And that's how I greet the day. I feel it and kind of hear this hum all the time. So I'm trying to get to sleep before, say, 12:30, 1 o'clock is futile. I just lie there in a bed that feels like there's a low-level tremor. It really affects my cognitive ability because I'm just tired all the time.
Yeah. Jennifer, I can barely imagine what that would be like. And Leon, I suppose it's the one thing we haven't really dived into too much this morning, is the environmental factors that can contribute heavily to insomnia.
Yeah, we've had people texting in about living on a busy road, all sorts of things.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence that living on a busy road can disturb people's sleep because road noise is quite variable, traffic going past and an occasional truck and so forth. And that's much more disturbing than a consistent noise, which you can get used to, like your refrigerator noise or air conditioner, which is on continuously and making the same pattern of noise all the time. So, yes, traffic noise certainly has been shown to be a difficulty for people's sleep. Earplugs, insulating the house can help if you don't have an option of moving away from a busy highway. There has been some recent interest in wind farm noise because of the increased number of wind farms in our culture. And we at Flinders just did a recent study. Another group in Sydney has done a similar study. Both of the studies have found that wind farm noise, when it's presented in the laboratory in a controlled situation, doesn't really have any noticeable or measurable effect on our sleep. Mm. And so the only thing that's likely, I think, to affect people's sleep if they can hear some wind farm noise in the background is their emotional reaction to the wind farm noise and becoming angry with it. And that, of course, then will disturb their sleep. But the actual low frequency and low background noise from wind farms doesn't appear to have any objective effect on sleep.
Leon, just changing tack a little bit quickly, Essie's one person who's texted in, many, many other people, just asking about circadian rhythms, asking about sort of when you feel like you get tired and ready for bed at a different time of the day to the rest of the world, feeling that disconnect. Obviously, I know circadian rhythms, we tend to work on a, diurnal cycle at the moment. We expect people to be asleep at night unless they're shift workers. But is it true that some people just don't have that same cycle for biological reasons?
Well, you're right, and this gets onto one of my favorite topics. I've been studying circadian rhythms for a long time, and they certainly do have a very strong effect on when we can sleep and when we should be awake. So if your circadian rhythm gets disturbed, and usually the disturbance is that it becomes delayed later than we would like it to be, and that can produce problems getting off to sleep initially at nighttime. Because across the 24-hour period, there is a period of alertness in our circadian rhythm, which is usually in the early evening. And if that period of alertness becomes delayed, then it can overlay the time that we would like to get to sleep, because we need to wake up at a certain time in the morning. In order to get enough sleep, we have to get to sleep, say, by 10:30 or 11 o'clock. And if our rhythms have become delayed, that creates a lot of difficulty getting you to sleep at that time. And so then if you have to wake up at the same time in the morning, then you don't get enough sleep. And so that sleep loss becomes a source of worry and concern. But then getting off to sleep has a much greater importance to you. And, of course, then you start worrying about it when you don't get to sleep right away. And that becomes a condition, a chronic insomnia condition.
Well, there's a text here that says, I explain my insomnia to others as moving through the day as a walking zombie. I never thought we would go down the route, but I find this fascinating of all of the advice around how to not get insomnia as a result of having an elderly cat with dementia. Sentence I never thought I'd say. But there are so many people like you, Nick, and the lengths at which people go to not get their own sleep, but to help the cat. This is amazing. Yep, that was me and my cat driving around the suburbs at 3:30 a.m. this morning, trying to stop my cat from howling and waking the rest of the house. Others saying, Nick, no, don't lock her in another room. Leave the light on so that she can see better and find her way out more easily to your bedroom where she normally sleeps. And another saying, my cat had dementia, got lost in the house and cried looking for her litter tray. So I bought a cat igloo with a heating pad, and I placed it in the porch area near her tray, and I locked the door. She was happy and warm and enclosed and could find her tray. You are not alone, my friend.
I am not alone. I love everyone who's got in touch about this. And a few people saying, you know, is she okay? Is it time to think about end of life? And look, this is a discussion that I have with a vet very regularly. So I do appreciate everyone's concern around that. So thank you for texting in.
Gabriel's in Balato.
Oh, I wanted to say that I had really poor sleep for 10 years, post-menopause and post-leaving a long marriage. And I knew from being a psychologist that waking up at the same time every morning helped, but I didn't do it. I slept in because I'm retired.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a puppy, which drove me insane for the first few months. But what I found is that he wakes me at 6 every morning and I'm sleeping a lot better.
Oh, that's so. How much of a difference has that made to your life, Gabriel?
Huge, absolutely huge. And the other thing is that he hops on the bed with me for another hour after 6. And because I'm a single woman and live alone, having the comfort of him on the bed while I just doze for a little bit is lovely. So it's actually really, really helped insomnia for me, having a pet.
So the consistency of routine, but also, yep, you know, the companionship.
I think so, yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that you're sleeping well now, Gabriel. Good to hear from you. Beryl's in Ararat. Good morning, Beryl.
Hello. Many years ago, 100 years ago, when the old Herald was up and running, they ran a sleep column with various techniques, as, you know, for people who were suffering sleep deprivation. And one of the techniques that I found really handy was that they said, because you're usually awake because your mind's really busy thinking about one thing or another, treat your mind as a stage and one by one consciously send whoever you're thinking about off into the wings until the stage is empty. And by that time, I was asleep.
I love all these techniques.
It would work for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And finding something that works for you as well. I love that. Leon Lack is with you, Emeritus Professor of Academic Status, the College of Education, Psychology and Social Work at Flinders University. We haven't really touched on menopause and perimenopause too much. So, you know, we've been talking about stages of life, Leon, maybe if and when you have young children. But what about as we age? You know, the theories that you need less sleep and, of course, menopause and perimenopause has a huge impact on our sleep.
Yes, it can, and not for everybody, but certainly that becomes a disturbance to sleep, and for some women that can be a source of awakening across the night. And then once those awakenings start occurring, with some difficulty getting back to sleep, then chronic insomnia can develop. So that certainly is a fragile period, if you like to call it that, during our development. But it occurs usually at the same time that our sleep need is gradually decreasing with age as well. So maybe our expectation that we should have 8 hours of solid sleep is not appropriate for somebody in their 40s and 50s. And that's something to take into consideration. But I'd like to get back to the earlier question that you posed. Mm. Are there any treatments for insomnia that work? We've been talking about insomnia in general and the difficulties it produces. Most people seeking treatment will go to a health professional and most often get a hypnotic drug of some sort, because that's the quickest and easiest way to produce some symptomatic relief. But unfortunately, it really only produces some symptomatic relief. It doesn't address the cause of the insomnia. And people can end up requiring hypnotic drugs for a long period of time, because when they stop using them, their insomnia comes back with a vengeance.
And do you find that that is still the go-to? Like if I was to go to my GP and say, you know, I haven't been sleeping, is the standard answer, well, you know, here's his pill, take this, do you think?
Yes, I was surprised by some recent research that shows that indeed that is still the case. With people that are diagnosed with chronic insomnia, about 90% of them end up getting hypnotic drug of one sort or another. Medical practitioners have been a little bit wary of the benzodiazepines, which have been the most common hypnotic over the last 20 or 30 years. And now they end up tending to prescribe other things like antidepressants, some of which have a mild sedating effect, and even some antipsychotics, which have a mild sedating effect. But again, it's a bit like taking an antihistamine. It's not a very beneficial effect, and in the long run, it doesn't really address the causes of the insomnia.
Leon, so, I know the problem with benzos back in the day was what we used to call the REM rebound effect, that they'd inhibit your REM sleep so you'd feel like you were getting a slightly better night's sleep. But when you stopped taking them because you thought you were back on an even keel, you'd start having significantly more REM sleep, which would make it feel like a more scattered sleep.
Yes, that is one of the issues with the benzodiazepines. And so that's one of the contributors to the dependency that people often experience, taking the drugs over a long period of time. But what I would like to mention is that for the last 40 or 50 years, we've known about what's called cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia. There are a number of behavioral techniques and cognitive therapies that really help to improve sleep and can provide a long-term and durable sort of treatment for the insomnia. So typically the ones that we see and we use cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia on, maybe 70 to 80% of our clients will show dramatic improvement.
Wow, that's a high number.
To the extent that...
How easy is that to access to be able to get treatment like that?
That is the big problem. Even though it is recommended as the first line of treatment, even in medical practice, medical practitioners don't have the time or the knowledge to carry that out.
So that's maybe questions we should be asking ourselves. I've just got a few things I want to quickly go through before we run out of time, Leon, because lots of people are asking about melatonin and whether or not that helps and whether you should be taking it long term as well.
Well, melatonin is a fairly innocuous substance, but it can, if taken in large doses, make you feel a bit drowsy in the next day. The evidence for it to help the typical chronic insomniac is not strong at all. What we do know about melatonin is that it can help change the timing of the circadian rhythm. And for people who have trouble getting off to sleep only and then tend to sleep in very late in the mornings and would like to be able to sleep earlier, then a low-dose melatonin in the early evening can be beneficial to help shift their rhythms back to an earlier time, along with morning bright light.
There's lots of questions coming in about circadian rhythm, and quite a few actually from pilots and those who work in aviation. This says circadian rhythms are very real. In aviation, we refer to them as WOCL, window of circadian low. Pilots must not complete 3 WOCL shifts in a row without access to 36 hours rest, including sleep accommodation. That's from Alan. There must be some professions, like pilots, where you can't get by on not enough sleep, Leon?
Oh, absolutely. And night shift is one of the biggest areas of difficulty there, because people are trying to perform and operate across the that window of bad performance and sleepiness, which occurs for most people between about 4 a.m. and 6 or 7 a.m. in the morning. And if it's a night shift that doesn't require a lot of attention, then, you know, you can take a quick nap perhaps and get away with it. But if you're in a very intensive
occupation. Yeah, if you're a surgeon, pilot.
Exactly. Or if you're people that control the air traffic controllers. At 4 o'clock in the morning, they're responsible for lots of people's lives and landing safely. And I've had clients in the past that have been that and having to work those night shifts. So keeping the number of night shifts at a minimum is the best advice if somebody has to do it.
Well, incredible advice that you've given us today. But, of course, we always say to speak to your local doctor. But I think today, Leon, we've learned to ask questions as well to find out, you know, what is appropriate for you or for your pet that may actually help you. So, Leon, thank you so much for all of your time this morning. We appreciate it.
Good talking to you.
Leon Lack there, Emeritus Professor of Academic Status at the College of Education, Psychology and Social Work at Flinders University. Nick Healy, I mean, my heart is exploding with just love and sadness and all sorts of things for the amount of people who have cats with dementia and the level of effort that they're going to make sure that they're okay. It's the sweetest thing ever.
I love it. They're family members. They always have been to me. I've owned cats for the last, you know, couple of decades of my life. I was never much for pets when I was a kid. It's been a later thing for me. But they're family members. You're going to do absolutely everything you can for them. And, Rochelle, I don't know if you saw this, but someone has texted a bit of advice for you that if you end up with Taylor Swift earworms, you just need to shake it off.
Oh, no, that will get stuck in my head now. Oh, my goodness. If you've missed any part of today's show or there's someone in your life who is living with insomnia that you think would want to listen to this, don't forget the Conversation Hour is a podcast. So you can go to the ABC Listen app. You can go to wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to this show. I know we've done other shows on sleep-related issues as well. So whatever the topic, the Conversation Hour will have a podcast for you to listen to. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care and we'll speak to you soon.